Will this next agenda be item be as easy?
No. And my purpose for being up here, good afternoon, members of the commission, Commissioner Bull, is to just let you know that we have seven items. It's on your agenda. We'll take those in sequence. We'll also have at the end a final recommendation of all the recommendations for the items. So we'll have one final recommendation, but staff will provide the recommendations as we move forward. I also want to remind you that Mr. Griss presented the results of the Baywide winter dredge survey last month. It was nothing to shout about on the spawning age females, just under 101 million. Please keep in mind the target is 215 million spawning age females. So we did move up from the depleted amount from the season before when there were 68.5 million pounds, but a low amount of spawning age females. On the positive side, the juvenile crabs, the abundance there was up from the previous season to 269 million. However, what you could consider in terms of spawning potential, which the commission is committed to this July framework, the juveniles are very important because they're the spawners in 2016. So what you can imagine from other years, such as we've had for 2013 and 2014, the spring overall, despite weather conditions, doesn't have a lot of spawning age crabs out there compared to other years. And the juveniles, which will move into the fisheries in late summer and fall, they also are the same crabs that will run the gauntlet of the bay fisheries and be the ones to provide spawning for 2016. So we'll have several staff members presenting today.
Ms. Allen?
So we have received some questions from the commission about effort. So we're going to just quickly go over a couple of those first before we start with the items. Beginning with looking at license eligibility, sales, and activity from 2005 through 2014. So your blue line is the number of individuals that are eligible for a crab pot license. The red line is the number of individuals that actually purchased their license. And then the green line is the number of individuals that actually reported using that license. So you can see the 2008-2009, that big drop in the number of eligible from the management that we did there to cut back on latent effort. And in 2005 to 2008, 50% of the eligible crab pot licenses were active, whereas now, since 2011, that's about 74-75% active. In 2009, there was a bump up in the amount of activity, about 83%, but in the last 3 or 4 years, that activity has leveled out. We also wanted to show effort by number of trips with our new management scheme of July to June. So this is from July 2013 to June 2014. Broken down by your pot categories. That's what the different colors are. Blue is the 85 pot license category, all the way up to your largest pot category, which is the orange for 455 pots. And then your N is the number of individuals within each category. So there was 216 individuals that had an 85 pot license within that management timeline that reported using it. And then we took that a little further and broke it down into how many trips they took. So of the 216 individuals with an 85 pot license, for example, about 110 took somewhere between 1 and 25 trips. And you can see for that 85 pot category, that kind of steadily declines. Your larger pot categories, your 255 and your 455, the 255 stays about equal until you get over 100 trips. And then your large pot, they stay about equal. They actually increase a little bit and then more into the full-time, so to say. And then the bottom graph is looking at the first half of our current season. So that was July 2014 through November. And then that will go until June of 2015. There was 131 possible days from July to November, so that's why we don't have anything over 150 down here. But you see the same kind of trends. Your smaller pot categories dip off while the other ones stay a little high and actually increase for your large categories. And sticking with this new management regime of July and then the new bushel limits, these bushel limits were did have industry input. They're considered a good day. So we wanted to see, you know, were these bushel limits attainable? Were they attained? So again, broken down by pot category, you can see your bushel limits. And then in November, these bushel limits drop. So then it's broken into the percent within each category that of how much they hit their bushel limits. So 25% of their bushel limit all the way up to getting all of their bushels. Their 85 pot category was the easiest for them to attain. But still only 12% of the 85-pot individuals hit 100% of their bushel limits from July to November, and then that jumps up to 21% at the end of November. So these limits are attainable, but they're not yet fully being reached. Looking at just from July to the end of November, it's about 12 million pounds from crab pots. If all of these were 100% reached, it would be 33 million pounds. And then there have been some questions of whether we've seen a shift from crabs to oysters since oysters have been doing well. Just looking at large scale, we have pounds, trips, and harvesters for 2011, 12, 13, and 14. Public oyster season starts in October. And there was actually an increase in the number of trips, pounds, and harvesters from fall 2013 to 2014. So just looking at large scale, we haven't seen that shift into the oyster industry, but that is something we could look into further. And then just my last little effort, information on effort before we start our items, just comparing our harvest versus our value. So your pounds from hard crabs is the dark bars, and then green is the dollar value for those. So we've actually had kind of a flip since 2011 and 12. Our harvest was actually more than the crabs were worth, but now you can see that the value for those crabs is higher than what the harvest has been.
Good afternoon. I have items 1 through 3 today, and these will be pertaining to the recommendations on your harvest season dates and your possession limits pertain mostly to Chapter 270. I do have some public comment for you. Let me get that up.
We need to wait until 5 people get here.
Yeah, Mr. Griss, we need to wait for a moment. We lost our quorum here.
These are all the same.
If they're clipped, they're all the same.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I didn't get clipped one.
There's four separate ones.
These are all the same. Yeah. They've been sitting there.
Mr. Hall, quorum being present, we safe to proceed?
Yep.
So I'll briefly go over this. You'll remember from our April presentation, we went over the winter dredge survey results, making note that, you know, compared to last year, where we are in the depleted state, 69 million spawning age female crabs, which is age 1+. You know, we've rebounded some up to 101, but as was noted earlier, you know, the target here on the abundance is actually currently 215 million spawning age females. So we have rebounded. We're not down there below that threshold anymore, but we got still ways of rebuilding to do on this. Juveniles are up. We went from 199 million juveniles to an estimate of 269 million. That's good. That represents both the juveniles will be part of our fall fishery starting in August, and then they also carry through to be our spawners in 2016, as was previously stated. So we definitely, you know, one of the things about this management season that we've entered into here is the conservation of those juveniles. So, you know, one of the things that we're going to make note of here is that we want to continue on this management approach. Basically right now, the July 5th through July 4th time frame, there will be some discussions in the future as we get toward our stock assessment in 2017 or so on crabs. That may shift a little bit more by a month or so. But basically, this time frame works out very well. A couple things that it does for us. One, we have this year's winter dredge survey results to look at to base the management for the upcoming 12 months. That's really timely results to work with. Those results usually come out earliest as April. Sometimes we don't get them until the early part of May. But, you know, that's the time frame. Gives us a month or so to work it out. But also as we go into next spring, one of the other benefits of this is, let's say we were to see a repeat of last year. All of a sudden we get preliminary results out, and we have another depleted situation that's happened. Environmental cause, whatever the cause was. We do have at least the ability at that point, knowing what we know from this year and watching that come in the next year, of saying, hey, we need to do an emergency action just to do what we can to protect the spawning class of this current season as much as we can until we get something a little further put in place. So this time frame works very well for management. It's more timely action on our part. So we're not trying to react. We're trying to get ahead of the curve a little bit. So that's really good. The other thing we want to keep in place, we made note of last month, was winter mortality. Now, the winter mortality estimates here that came out of this last survey, they're not the highest that have been seen. They've been much higher seen in some winters. But they are still a substantial amount. When you're talking about 20% of the spawning age female abundance was lost. It should have been 125 million. We're at 101. On juveniles, that's the T zeros on the graph. You know, we lost 32,000. So instead of the 268, 269 million we talked about, we're talking about it could have been as high as 301 million. So again, we've seen higher amounts, but it is something that, you know, we have to make note of. It's one of those environmental factors that does play a role in our fishery. So on the different seasons, passed out a blue paper copy of Chapter 270. So this is the regulation that contains the majority of our seasonal information, including our possession limits. One thing we'd like to make note of is a continuation of what we are doing now with our seasons. You will note that in Section 40 of Chapter 270, what we're trying for lawful seasons here is from May 1 through September 25th this year, and from April 21 through November 30th of next year, we'd like to set the season for the other crab gears, the non-crab pot gears. That's a change from this year. Am I saying that correct? Yeah, I am. That is a change from this year. This season, we were in a situation where we stopped the non-crab pot gears after September 15th of last year, and we reopened it May 1st of this year. Now, that had big impacts in different parts of the bay at different times. Last fall, it had a larger impact than the northern part of the bay, especially up toward Tangier Island and the hand scrapers up there. For the May 1st, it delayed a lot of the peeler pounds getting set up, and also the peeler pot fishery more towards Southern Bay and Western Shore. So we heard from both areas of the Chesapeake Bay last summer on comments about this. One of the reasons we're using dates on the non-crab pot gears versus bushel limits, which is what we do use on the bushel on the crab pot gears, is because There is a situation where with crab pots, we can do bushel limits. You know, we've had discussions from the commission in front of the Crab Management Advisory Committee about effort control and the number of pots out there, and had many admit, you know, they run more pots than they legally can because there actually is not a clear way to enforce that. But bushel limits are very enforceable, and they work. And there is a mixed opinion about bushel limits, even with the Crab Committee. Though they didn't have a consensus opinion on bushel limits at their last meeting, you had various opinions come from that committee. You know, one was, you know, go back to the old way of doing things, where all gears could have up to 51 bushels and then unlimited. And then you had other members who commented about keeping the bushel limits, but nothing in a consensus matter came out of that. When it comes to the non-crab pot gear, so bushel limits, is every time we've looked into it, it's not a usable format for them yet. There's a lot of discard in this fishery. There are some that are very clean with the peeler fishery, but then there are some, admittedly, who are not. And with reporting, some report what they harvest out of the water, some report what they sold and not what they harvested. That means there's a large amount of discard that goes unreported. In the early part of the season, in April especially, we had a very big April in March back in 2012. When you're having the early part of the season with peeler, you're dealing with a lot of what they call green sign crabs. They haven't gone quite the white sign. There is a lot of loss in that fishery when you have an early run. So there's different things that come into this recommendation. It's not just let's go pick a date and try and stick to it. We're trying to factor in a lot of information, a lot of input from industry on setting these dates. So what we're looking at here, again, on the other non-gear is instead of September 15th, closure, go all the way out to September 25th and then start on April 21st next year instead of starting on May 1st on the non. On the crab pots, keep the same season as is, March 17th through November 30th. Also, we had a lot of public comment. I passed out a lot of that to you already. We had quite a bit of public comment on this. There are some who would like to see the peeler opened up even earlier and not have any restrictions at all on it. But for the points I just raised, you know, this is the recommendation that we can based on the available science that we have on this. We also have recommendation on the bushel limits for the crab pot fishery. Staff is recommending maintaining the current bushel limits. You heard staff a few minutes ago come up and they talked about how much was basically attained through that fishery. You had the little chart up there about how many made 25% of the bushel limit or 50% of the bushel limit. You saw very few actually got to the 100% on each of the crab pot categories, the primary one being this smaller crab pot category, the 85 crab pots. There is a potential sitting there where they harvested 12 million pounds of blue crab last fall in a basically a five-month period. The potential was for 33 million, had everyone attained their bushel limits. So there's a lot of potential just at the current bushel limits, which are set at the good standard that industry provides us advice on. There's a lot of potential still sitting there, and we haven't reached that potential. This is a good conservation measure to stay where we are. There's still a lot of room for harvest under these limits, and we are still in a situation when we go back and look at the winter dread survey results and that 101 million female crabs, we want to make sure that we're doing conservation still through next season. We want to see even more next year as spawners and keep building that number back up. We want to get back that 215 or as close to it as we can. So on these three points, that's the staff recommendation. And then the following points 4 through 7 will follow. Any questions?
Any questions from the commission? Thank you, Mr. Briss.
Thank you.
Good afternoon again. This item for the public hearing actually started as a concern expressed by our law enforcement division, and it really ties back to the crab pot bushel limits. As we noted, this is really just the last year that we've had what is considered a more realistic industry standard for these year-round bushel limits. And the year-round bushel limits, as a management tool, have only been in place for a couple of seasons. So we're seeing what might be a potential loophole here. Within code 28.2-713, it allows individuals with a buyer's license to have in their possession greater than the daily possession limit of either crabs in this case or fin fish. We have a boat buyer's license. There's actually very few that are sold each year. The past 5 or 6 years, there's only been 10 to 12 boat buyer's licenses sold. In 2015, out of the 11 sold, 6 of them, over half of the licenses sold, are to individuals that also have their crab pot licenses, which their crab pot license would tie them to a daily possession limit. The buyer's license would then exempt them from that daily possession limit. Fisheries management staff has worked with the law enforcement division here, and we're proposing a new subsection within Chapter 4 VAC 270, or excuse me, 20-270, and you see the wording before you here, that would prohibit anyone on board a vessel that possesses a crab pot license and also possesses a seafood buyer's license to buy crabs on that day. So basically they're going to need to either act as a boat buyer or a crab potter on that day. And we hope that the wording that we have here would address that. So staff's recommending this additional amendment to Chapter 270. That's all I have.
Any questions, yes. Mr. Smith? Mr. Neal.
Yeah, sorry. I guess my question comes to, and I guess this is law enforcement, I'm assuming you all went through this, how is this enforceable?
Well, in the event, if law enforcement would care to answer, but in the event that an individual is in possession greater than their current license possession limit, I would assume that the...
But then you would have to actually see them working pots, correct? I mean, because they could say they bought those crabs from somewhere else, or...
Well, sorry, the chief is saying that the possession of the license would be, the possession of, right. If that vessel is in possession of greater than their daily possession.
So if they have the seafood buyer's license on board, they could still be working their pots unless you actually see them working the pots. Because then you don't know whether they bought the crabs or they picked them up out of the pots.
We worked on this with law enforcement.
I figured you did.
I think we have it fairly good here.
Okay.
So the idea is all you have to do is have your crab pot license with you. And then if you're also buying crabs, and what would flag law enforcement would be to see that someone or here, take your pick, has more than their vessel limit. Then, they're going to be in violation for having a buyer's license and a harvester's license, a crab pot license. So law enforcement did find this going on. That's why we're here today, because they saw a few instances where that activity picked up, like Mr. Cimino said. So I think this is going to be fairly stable as far as being able to detect this.
Any other questions from the commission?
I got one.
Mr. Zedrin.
Are you saying here that here's a guy who's got both the seafood buyer's license and a crab pot license? When he goes out that day, he can only have one in his possession, either the seafood buyer's license or the crab pot license?
On that trip, they can only act as one or the other.
Then ask you that. Okay. What I'm asking you here is when they leave the dock, does this say that you must either have whatever you're going to do that day? If you're going to be the buyer, you got to have a buyer's license. But you can't have the seller's, the crab pot license. Or does it still allow the same guy to carry both of those licenses on that vessel at the same time? You understand what I'm trying to say?
I absolutely do. And staff realizes that the way these licenses are printed, it's actually possible that they wouldn't even be able to separate the two, or that they're printed on one piece of paper so that they would both be in their possession.
Well, it goes along with Dr. Neal's thing here. How do we know that what election they made for that day? I mean, if they go out there and get their crab pots and they get excess of their crab pot license, all of a sudden they're the buyer. I mean, how is this going to affect that or prohibit it?
Well, with the assumption...
I'm going to help. I'm going to try and help here, if you don't mind. I'm going to try and help.
No, I don't mind.
If you have both licenses and you have the crab pot license in your possession, you just aren't going to be able to buy on the last line down there. In other words, if you have that, you cannot buy crabs that day. So the solution is going to be leave your crab pot license on shore if you can.
Well, that's my point, but he's saying it's printed on the same sheet, so how are you going to do that?
Some are, but the way that's taken care of is at the bottom here is that if you have them both, you're not going to be able to buy the crabs.
Okay. Okay.
Because we did work on that last week, that very same question you just asked.
Okay.
Any other questions of Mr. Smith? Mr. Ballard.
So is there a substantial difference in the limit from a buyer to a harvester? Is that the idea in that they're
yes,
then combining
yes.
it?
Absolutely. Right.
And
yeah.
So if they went over the harvester's limit, they would then say, oh, but I'm a buyer and I bought these
right.
many
Right, and back to the Chapter 610, and within our mandatory reporting regulations are the requirements for seafood buyers, which would then, you know, at some point they would need to produce records that they purchased from some other individual at that point.
So it's not feasible to attack this from a bushel limit perspective rather than a license on board perspective.
Yeah, I don't think there's any intention from law enforcement to cap a seafood buyer using, you know, purchasing from a boat just to prohibit both the potential for both being done when they stop an individual.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Smito. Ms. Ellen.
Item 5 is for sponge crabs, just Chapter 370 pertaining to the culling of crabs. If you've never seen a sponge crab, here she is with her eggs on her abdomen. So the current regulation from March 17th to June 30th, it's unlawful for an individual to possess a dart sponge crab. There is a tolerance of 10 per bushel. So meaning July 1st, they are able to possess them. This has been a talk at CMAQ for a while about changing this regulation. So Dr. Lipschitz presented mortality data at our May 18th meeting about sponge crabs and water temperatures to see if there was any flexibility with that June 30th date. Through his data, which he will present today, he supports amendments to make it unlawful to possess dark sponge crabs from March 17th through June 15th. So this would be moving it from June 30th to the 15th. So beginning June 16th, those individuals will be able to possess those dark sponge crabs. He's going to show you some information on the science side of things.
Okay, good afternoon. So I'm going to show you the information that we've been gathering for several years on trap and handling mortality for females and why we are in support of the recommendation. So the problem is that the current regulations, or the issue is that the current regulations prohibit the take of brown and black sponge female crabs in June. And the original idea was that the crabs did not necessarily suffer high mortality, so that if you put crabs overboard after catching them, that they would survive and reproduce. So there's been a fair amount of new research and so on, and so what I've done is try to integrate it all to assess whether or not that actually still holds. So what we've done, we've looked at many different scientific publications. That's what the literature review is, technical reports, and as such. And then, of course, we're also going to present the relevant information that we have. So we do not have any, or we have very little information on egg viability. So if you catch a crab that has an egg mass, what happens to the eggs? We do have some work that we conducted along with the University of Maryland that suggested that eggs don't really survive particularly well when you bring them out of the water, and especially when it's hot out. This is the only study that has been done on egg mortality specifically, or egg viability. It was done in North Carolina, so it has somewhat similar conditions to what we experience. And I'm going to show you the important data. So what they did is, across the bottom is crab size. And so these are all legal size females, mature females. These were collected, and they assessed, this is the percent of the sponge that remains, from 40 to 100% after some amount of time that they've been either dip netted or trap caught. And so what you see here is that basically you have pretty high viability of the eggs for dip netted crab. So they just went out and dip netted sponge crab in North Carolina. So generally about 90 to 100% of the eggs were still viable. On the other hand, from the North River and the Newport River in North Carolina, only there was 20 to 55% egg mortality. So most of the egg masses of those females that were brought up, and this is under warmer conditions, were lost. So that's something to keep in mind. They did not find an effective temperature, but they did most of their study during the warmer times, but it did include June through August, and I believe part of September. Okay, so that's what we know as far as the egg masses. So that would suggest that when a female is brought up, that a lot of the eggs are going to be lost from that damage and so on. And of course, that'll probably depend quite a bit on how many other crabs are in the crab pots and such. So what we did is we conducted a series of studies, and I'm showing you the results of one study here, but I'm going to show you the full set in a minute. To tell you what we did, what we basically did is we went out with different crabbers, in this case Pete Freeman. I think many of you, not most, all of you know Pete. He's a longtime crabber, had been a longtime crabber until he got a stroke. And so we had gone out with him, and then what we would do is we did two things. We went out with him, and then immediately upon capture of the crabs, at the point where he would then be tossing the crabs back, we then took the crabs and put them into crab pots, single crab pots, so the crabs were not interacting, having aggression with other crabs. We fed them and gave them plenty of food for the whole period, and then followed their survival rates. And this is an example of what was happening in August. August is the hottest time of the year, and what you see is the percentage that were still alive as a function of the number of days. And you can see it's a pretty darn high mortality rate. I mean, most of those crabs were dying when it was really hot. And a couple things about that study, what it showed is that there was really no effect of sponge, whether a crab was clean or whether it had an orange sponge or whether it had a brown or black sponge, they all had similar mortality rates. So we're not talking about the eggs, we're talking about the females. So all the females, whether clean or not, were suffering pretty high mortality when caught in the traps. The other thing that was surprising to us is that most of that injury or stress was happening in the traps. It wasn't happening because, remember, we were taking the crabs right away, and we had a study where we did it ourselves where we immediately took the crabs, did not expose them to the hot temperatures on board the boat. It was all that stress actually happening underwater where the water temperatures are quite warm. So you see our data and Mr. Freeman's data, and it basically indicated about a 13% mortality per day, which means that after a couple weeks, almost all of them were dead. And the other thing that we did not incorporate here or in the other studies is that we have not incorporated the effects of multiple captures. So if you catch a female one time and then release her, she's already fully stressed, and then if she gets caught again, and again, there's the mortality rate is going to be even higher. So this was one of the main reasons why the commission voted to eliminate the ban on brown and black sponges some years ago. Okay, so now let me show you what we have for several, for multiple seasons, for several months. Let me orient you. So what I did here is we conducted all these different studies. We conducted two different studies in August, one in June, July, September, May, and November. And What I did is I plotted these data in terms of the water temperature at which the study was conducted. And to orient you, this is in degrees centigrade, and 25 degrees, so right here, is equivalent to 77 degrees Fahrenheit. Comfortable with that. It turns out that if you look at all the data, that there's a pretty sharp, and this is the proportion alive. So what fraction of the females were alive at the end of the about a 1 to 2 week study after being caught in regular crab traps. And some of these were sort of in mesocod or in field studies as well as with the crab. And what we find is that there's a pretty sharp decline right around 24 to 26 degrees centigrade. That's when the survival drops off pretty sharply. May, really good survival, November, and then of course later on in September when it's cooler, it's pretty decent. But when you get to July, June, and August, and especially when you're right around 24 to 26 degrees centigrade, that's a sharp reduction in survival. So we are assuming that once, and so if you were to take this data, for instance, let's say here you've got a survival rate of about 60 to 70%. That's after one trap capture. So if she's caught again several times, it's going to be probably less than 50%, 40% that she will survive at those temperatures. So now what I did is I wanted to look at what happens to water temperature in general. Now, I can't do it across the whole bay. I mean, we could do it across the whole bay, but I wanted to get a representative site. So I looked at the water temperatures, in this case, for the Coast Guard station in Yorktown. Here I'm showing, this is simply, and I'm not going to go through this data. I'm going to show you one example in a minute. This is from the 1st of June to the 30th of June. And it shows you the water temperature through the month for five different years. There's actually a pretty similar pattern that occurs. Whether it's been a severe winter or a very warm winter, the temperatures change around the same time. I'm going to show you in a minute. So basically what I'm showing you is a representative example, but I wanted you to know that I looked at many years, decades actually, of data. So here's an example. This is from last year, 2014. And then this is 25 degrees centigrade, remembering that that's 77 degrees Fahrenheit. And coincidentally, the time in June at which it goes above that, and it's sort of just gently rising, but then once it gets to past middle of June, it stays high at that level. And that was consistent from year to year. So because of that, then we are suggesting or in support of the idea of eliminating the brown and black sponge ban starting June 16th because we feel that any crabs tossed back or most crabs tossed back are really going to be wasted to the fishery, from the fishery as well as the population. And the additional benefit of that is that if the crabbers can keep those, then of course they're not going to go and catch other crabs or recapture these crabs. So I think overall, I would suggest that that's a benefit to the population and to the fishery. And so we're in support of that. I think that's my last. Yes. Next one is for sanctuary.
Any questions from the commission?
I have a quick question.
Ms. Erskine.
I had a quick question about the study that you did where you took the crab from the crabber and put it into your pot separately and followed its survival. Do you think there was an added stress going into a crab pot, whereas if a crabber tosses it overboard, they're obviously not putting it in a pot. It's swimming away to maybe a refuge or something like that where it can hide and rehabilitate. Do you anticipate there would be any difference in survivability?
I don't really, because we've held crabs like that. When you hold them individually and you give them food, they do very well, especially if we're putting them back into good condition. So in general, I would not expect it. Of course, the crabbers have told us that one of the other things we need to account for is the number of crabs in the crab pot, which we didn't in that case. And we are going to try to do that in June. But it's typically just the stress of interactions along with the warm temperature.
Okay.
Any other questions from the commission? Thank you, Ron.
So at CMAQ's meeting in May, by unanimous vote, CMAQ approved a motion to recommend the commission make the prohibition of dark sponge crabs extend from March 17th to no later than June 15th. They gave themselves that no later than June 15th verbiage just in case there was any more arguments to change that date up a little further. They didn't want to lock themselves in entirely. Staff also is following VIMS and recommends amendments to Chapter 370 pertaining to the culling of crabs to make it unlawful for any person to possess dark sponge crabs from March 17th to June 15th. So that's what your blue paper reflects, just changing that June 30th up to June 15th.
Thank you, Andy. Any questions from the commission? Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to discuss item number six on the blue crab discussion. Item number six is proposed changes to the closed time periods of areas in the blue crab sanctuary. Under item six, we're going to discuss two separate items. One is amendments to the closed time periods of areas in the blue crab sanctuary, and the second is amendments to sanctuary area four specifically. Okay, so currently, this is our blue crab sanctuary. It's over 1,000 square miles that is intended to protect mature females as they begin their temperature-driven migration from the south to the mouth of the bay to release their eggs. It also aids in reducing the exploitation rate. So currently, the sanctuary closes on May 16th through September 15th for commercial and recreational harvest. So areas 1 and 3 is closed to commercial and recreational harvest, while areas 2 and 4 is only closed to commercial harvest when the sanctuary is closed. Area 2 is what we call the historical sanctuary. This was established in 1942. The geographic location is bound by law. However, the commission has the ability to amend any dates for closures. This is also an important part of the sanctuary, and about 20% of mature females are resident in this area of the sanctuary during the May and June spawning period. So CMAQ has spent the last several months discussing, you know, various issues within the industry, but two have revolved around the sanctuary. The first is relieving congestions in waters outside of the sanctuary when the sanctuary is closed, so pushing harvesters outside of the sanctuary and what's happening to those harvesters, as well as the disparity of available harvest between the northern and southern portions of the bay before the sanctuary closes. And by that, to explain that a little bit more, there's differences in salinity and water temperature between the northern and southern portions of the bay during the spring. So this results in earlier and greater availability of crabs in the southern area than in the northern area to harvest before the sanctuary closes on May 16th. We also know that data shows that prior to the sanctuary expansion, effort was higher in the main stem of the bay during May and June than after the expansion. So staff has proposed a rolling type closure to address some of these disparities. So the first thing that is proposed is splitting Sanctuary 1 into two geographical sections, 1A and 1B, and the rest would remain the same. And for rolling closures, 1A would be the last to close at June 1. 1B would remain the same closure dates as it is now, and areas 2, 3, and 4 would close at May 9th. So this is really supposed to address the fact that harvesters in the northern portion of the bay have less time and less crabs available in the spring to harvest, while the southern portion has a greater availability and more time to harvest crabs before the sanctuary closes. So Dr. Vims has looked at the conservation equivalency of this.
Dr. Vims, I like that. It's a new name, Dr. Vims.
interesting to have the Lipsius Institute of Marine Science.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon again. So my sole responsibility was to assess whether or not that represented the options represented an approximate conservation equivalency in terms of the spawning potential. And so what I did is I drew on a couple different data sets, some that we have published already from, which is what you see here from the VIMS trawl survey, and in a minute I'll ask you to focus only on the rectangles, not the whole data set. And so again, this was derived from long-term studies of the VIMS trawl survey, and then I'm also going to show you some new data that I've been examining from ChessMap, which is a different survey run by VIMS. Okay, so let me go over here. Let me orient you. So I won't go over that. Originally I was asked to look at different options, but here we're only considering that one option where this area is closed June 1st and this area is closed May 9th. So if we look, this is a VIMS trawl survey data set. This gives you, on this axis, is adult female abundance. And it's for three different areas, what I had called the upper impact, lower impact, and historical sanctuary. This is when the original sanctuary was being devised. So the upper stands for marine protected area. So this is the upper area. Notice an important thing, the upper area actually is here. The suggested change is actually this line. So there's an area here that's actually included in the part of the sanctuary that's not going to be affected, that is under this. You've got the lower impact, which is the middle portion, and then the historical sanctuary. So that's what this is. The upper impact is here, lower, the bulk of the sanctuary, and then the historical sanctuary. And these are densities of females. And it doesn't change much. So this is density of all females, mature females. And I'm only focusing on this because it's the most representative of what's happening now. And it's in June, the data series that we have. The main thing to get from this is that there are about equal numbers of females, densities of females. So that's important, densities of females in this area as in this area. So given that we're cutting off this part and adding this part, it would suggest that, in fact, there is a conservation equivalency, that it's about that 1 to 2 week time period is important. And, of course, given that these crabs are much more active down here, then that makes even for a better situation in terms of conservation. Now, I drew on the ChessMap data because that's actually a little more extensive data set. So I'm going to show you some two representative years. And again, I did the same thing as I did with the water temperature. I pulled representative years that basically show you what generally happens from year to year. Okay, now here, and we're only going to focus now for the May cruise. So they have several different cruises. The abundance is basically proportional to the size of these different symbols. So you can actually see what's going on here. Little triangles, no crabs caught, on up to the squares are 10 plus mature females per tow. And if you look at May, you see what we're talking about, that in this case, most of the females, actually the highest concentrations of females, are down here, particularly down here in the lower in the historical sanctuary. And you notice in this case there are a lot of zeros, all those little triangles are samples, but with no crabs. So there are crabs there. A few crabs there. Here's another representative year. And what you see is a similar sort of thing, that you've got the highest concentrations within the bulk of the sanctuary, the main part of the sanctuary, as well as the historical sanctuary, and then some low to moderate densities. By the way, I just want to point out another interesting thing that happens, and this happens every year, that in the fall, the females from Maryland typically don't start coming down until the fall of the year after the anoxia goes. So that's why you see a lot of these are females coming from the tribs in Maryland waters going down to this is that given the generally higher densities of crabs in the historical sanctuary and offshore, that and the differences in temperature as well as activity levels, it all suggests that, to me, that I think it's appropriate conservation measure to adopt the new options for that. And so VIMS would be in support of that option.
Any questions from the commission? Thank you, Dr. VIMS.
Okay, so I also wanted to discuss on page 6 of your evaluation, you can see that we have quite a lengthy history for amendments to the sanctuary. So as I mentioned, Sanctuary Area 2 was established in 1942. That had a June 1 closure until 2009. Most of the other sanctuaries or sanctuary areas also had June 1 closures until 2008. So Sanctuary Area 1 in 2000 was June 1 through September 15th. Areas 1, 3, and 4 were also June 1 through September 15th. And then in 2009, the legislator gave us the ability to amend Area 2 sanctuary. And in, at that time, in 2009, we changed everything, all dates, from May 1 to September 15th. And that was when we were really focusing on female conservation. In April 2011, we gave back a little bit and moved from May 1 to May 16th, which is what it's currently at. So at the last CMAC meeting in May, there were no motions made to made pertaining to sanctuary closures during the meeting. However, these closures were developed based on discussions throughout several meetings we've had this year. These changes are also proposed for 2016. So that will allow the CMAC and industry to further discuss any future modifications that they would like to add to the Blue Crab Sanctuary areas before then. And in that time, this gives us something to work for if no decisions are made. So the staff recommendation, staff recommends amendments to Chapter 752 pertaining to Blue Crab Sanctuary to redefine the Virginia Blue Crab Sanctuary Area 1 as Virginia Blue Crab Sanctuary Area 1A and 1B, and implement separate closure dates for Blue Crab Sanctuary areas, Sanctuary Areas 1A, 1B, and Areas 2 through 4.
Any questions from the commission? Thank you, Rachel. Mr. Lichtis. Please come on up.
Thank you. Well, just one point of clarification that I think it's important for you to know. The original sanctuary was drawn as is based on discussions with then-Colonel Bowman to try to have it set up so that there would be obvious and clear landmarks that you, that enforcement could then use to enforce the sanctuary. And that's why the line goes the way it goes up in 1A, separating 1A and 1B. In case you were thinking.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, the second portion of the sanctuary discussion is amendments to Sanctuary Area 4. In the April meeting, the CMAC proposed to redefine an area from Cape Henry south to Rudy Inlet seaward a half a mile from Blue Crab Sanctuary Area 4 to remain open when the sanctuary is closed. So you can see the small pink part is the area that they're recommending. Area 4 was established to offset a reduction in days that sponge crabs were prohibited from a total prohibition to the current July 16th closure, and that was in April of 2007. It intended to prevent the movement of effort into the coastal area when the sponge crab prohibition was removed, and to also reduce the harvest of sponge crabs in that area. Historically, very few crab potters actually utilized this area prior to the closure. On April 2015, the CMAC voted unanimously, the chair did not vote, to amend the proposed portion of Blue Crab Sanctuary Area 4 to remain open from May 16th through September 15th. And this was really to alleviate congestion during the closure of the sanctuary. The City of Virginia Beach has contacted the VMRC about this proposal, but has not yet publicly commented. Staff does not recommend an opening of a portion of this portion of the Blue Crab Sanctuary Area 4 because of potential user conflicts in this high traffic area, and also to conserve sponge crabs in that area.
Any questions from the commission? Thank you, Rachel.
Ran out of staff, so I have to come back up. All right, item 7, fall and winter crab dredge fishery season. Just a little historical point. Back in October 22nd of 2013, staff had come before the commission at a time when we were talking about possibility of having a winter crab dredge fishery season opening. And at that meeting, in the end of the day, it did not happen, but there was some directives from the commission, and one was to establish a trigger mechanism for such an opening. And though we had at that time a draft trigger mechanism proposed, they wanted us to go before the Chesapeake Bay Stock Assessment Committee and work with them to get the work out the trigger and get it approved. So we've done that. Over the last year and a half, we've gone through a couple of iterations with CBSAC and worked out, you know, what's the best approach to having a trigger for the opening of the winter crab dredge fishery season. What we have come up with is looking at the years where we did not have an exploitation fraction above 29%. Now, that comes in just a little less than halfway between our target and threshold values, the 25.5% target and the 34% threshold for the exploitation rate on our female crabs. And then look from that data, from the information, and look at the following year and the abundance values coming out of the following winter dredge survey, with the understanding that that exploitation rate is impacting both the juvenile class from the preceding year that becomes our spawnings of that year. It also has some impact as well on the actual amount of juveniles that come in because it's impacting the spawners. So we're trying to, basically it's a cast forward type of approach. So we take that information, we stop worrying about the exploitation rate at that point, we've figured out what years we want to use, and we take the average of those years, the arithmetic mean. And what we're looking for is a juvenile abundance based on the arithmetic mean that's above 264 million crabs and a spawning age female abundance of 129 million. So we want to be above that. We want to be above both of them for this trigger to operate and coming back to commission and say, okay, we've hit these triggers. Now let's go back and take the points that we laid out in October 22nd that the commission endorsed for working toward having a winter dredge fishery season opening. Going through these iterations, our juvenile crab abundance for this year at 269 million was definitely above the juvenile abundance from the trigger. So trigger one was tripped. However, trigger two was not. Only have 101 females. And for that, for this proposal to work, we need to have it at least above 129. So with this, the staff recommendation, just based on the trigger alone, there's more to come on this, would be not based on the trigger. To not have an opening of the winter crab dredge fishery season. And this is using the directives from the October 22nd, 2013 meeting. So is there any questions on the triggers before we move forward on anything else? Close.
Well, as far as the dredge fishery and opening it up on triggers, and you know I've never been a big fan on triggers.
Very clear.
Just because if we go back to code section 28-200 on discrimination, and if we read down here,
You know, it says conservation and management measures shall not discriminate against user groups. If it is, it becomes necessary to allocate and assign fishing privileges among various user groups. The Drudge fishery was historically the oldest fishery there ever was. It was out before pot fishing. It was out before trout lining. It was out before anything. I do not think the Drudge fishery should have any closure or any trigger set up to be opened back upon. My two cents.